books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show recorded in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and today Lucy Nicol / Lucy Roth take us to a party to end all parties. Plus, we'll find some new books in the RNIB library. Lucy Roth / Lucy Nicol is described as a writer with a love of flawed characters and tales from the darker side of life. We'll chat about music, mental health and writing under different names during the show, but first let's talk about her new book, The Party to End All Parties, written under the name Lucy Roth, which came out last week. The audio version is read by Harley Vivish, Chelsea Halfpenny and Lucy's husband, Chris Connell.
Angel wings lie spread-eagled on the grass, punctured by scorch marks and ash. Tab ends and a burnt-out roach decorate the netting like trashy beading. The camera points upwards to a sky streaked with soft ribbons of lilac, pink and pale orange. Treetops moving gently beneath. A tuft of white hairs occasionally obscures the lens. Quick, short sniffing sounds overwhelm the audio before a magpie revs up its angry chatter in the distance. The camera points downwards towards the grass, and a grating sound can be heard, like a train on the tracks. The grating stops, and the camera pans around to where a fountain stands in the distance, shaped like petals atop a smooth stone column. Water trickles down gracefully, like liquid silk. Neat gravel paths and well-kept lawns frame the fountain, the intense green interrupted by wine bottles, sunglasses and small pieces of discarded food. A twisted wooden dome with a covered entrance and latticed sides stands tall to the left, while to the right is a vacant stage with speakers either side of a table. The lens stops and shakes. Violently, a fast scratching sound. A grand house is almost fully in view now, large and imposing. It is bordered by low-level structural hedging and stone-covered walkways. The camera moves towards the house, its brickwork bold and solid. A grey-white statue to the right reveals an amalgamation of stony human forms, a bare bottom beaming proudly into view. The camera manoeuvres to the left of the house, heading up a small slope at speed. Trip-trap, trip-trap. And then it turns to the right and enters the building. A raw stone floor is decorated haphazardly with patterned cushions and people. Endless human bodies drape across each other like layers of fleshy rock. A half-empty bottle of something cradled in broken glass, its dark blue label only partly visible, exposing fragments of gold script. Bare feet hug bare feet. Someone is snoring. A human face comes into view. Its pointed nose twitching and its top lip shiny with sweat. Its owner lets out a low, guttural groan and the camera backs away.
I'm Lucy Roth and The Party to End All Parties is a thriller which has been described as Saltburn meets Succession.
Now, what have you got against vile, rich narcissists?
Well, I've really enjoyed watching things like Succession, and over the kind of the course of the season, I love how, because all of the key characters are quite are very unlikable in many ways, I just like how the writers encourage you to kind of root for them at different points, but like the whole time you're checking yourself because you're like, actually, they're a horrible narcissistic billionaire. But they're kind of, you jump around in terms of which sibling you're kind of rooting for each episode. So, yeah, I quite like the idea of playing with kind of quite unlikable characters.
The tagline is, a little party never killed anyone. What happens at the opening party?
So the very opening scene is described as if you're looking through a moving camera. and what you can see. And we actually discover that what you're looking through is a camera that is attached to a goat. So this is one of the devices that I use through. So it's describing everything that the goat's camera can see. And at the very start of the book, it's quite clear that the goat has happened upon a dead body and blood spatter.
The view moves towards spiral steps, swerving to avoid a doll hanging from the wall, its eyes staring. The camera heads down the steps and stops. A pink mass fills the screen. The camera jolts in and out, a white furry chin prodding at the soft texture. The focus moves, and wiry black hair fills one half of the view. Some kind of fleshy mound flopping among the hair completes the other half of the picture. The view moves again, scaling a limb before panning out to reveal a hand, its fingers forming an impossible backwards mangled V-shape. The camera reverses once more. A tongue sticks out and licks the ground, lapping something. Whiskers and white fur appear in the top of the screen, globules of a bright red substance lodged within them. Thick red liquid spatters the lens.
So basically, the story centers around this huge party that the siblings throw at their magnificent stately home, which gets a little bit wild and raucous. And during the party, during the proceedings, they discover that there is a dead body at the bottom of the stairs in the old cellar. And they're all kind of pointing the finger at each other, but they've got to clear this body away, clear away the evidence, make sure that everything is as it should be, because Granny is sending the estate inspection and inspection team round the following morning, because she is about to decide which of the siblings will inherit the estate. So it's the stakes are pretty high for the siblings.
Yeah, they're not only all in it together, they're also all against each other as well at the same time.
Yeah, totally. In fact, like, there's a little part of the plot is that Granny says to them, either it will be shared amongst you evenly, or if one of you disagrees, then it will only go to one of you. And one of the siblings says no to the equal shares. So that is why they're kind of, yes, they're kind of in it together, but they are very suspicious of one another. They don't really trust each other.
Was it fun to write such nasty characters?
Oh my God, yes, yes. I know that there's kind of a debate around whether you do need a likable character. I mean, few people who have reviewed it said, well, the goat's a lovely character. And the main protagonist, Cassie, she's morally grey, but I think she's likable. But I just do think there is something really fun around writing characters that are just kind of so beyond anyone you'd want to invite round for dinner. they're just so awful. But I just think there's something really satisfying about kind of exploring those extreme characters and then creating scenarios in which, you know, they're basically going to implode. So that's the satisfying part of it. And I don't think I'm giving any spoilers away, really, because it is a bit of a eat the rich book, I suppose.
One of the reviewers said your description of how to look after the goat, Iggy, was spot on. Have you ever owned a goat before?
Actually, Iggy the goat is named after... So my husband, for a little while over the pandemic period and just before, was looking after a goat at an urban farm, and the goat was called Iggy. He looked after a few different ones. And so Iggy the goat in The Party to End All Parties is actually named after that lovely little goat who is sadly no longer with us. So, yeah, I basically picked my husband's brains for, you know, how might a goat react? Where might they live? What might they eat, et cetera, et cetera. And then, of course, when it came to the audio book, because he is an actor and narrator and presenter as well. And I suggested, well, I put him forward to the audio team. And what was really great about that is that I'd written in like the sounds that the goat makes when it's frightened or whatever. So he was able to capture that in his narration because he'd spent so much time with the real Iggy the goat. So, yeah, so it was a lot of fun.
The sound of a car engine gets closer and wheels can be heard crunching on gravel. The camera is shaky and gets faster and faster, the stones coming in and out of view before it stops, suddenly, and follows the movement of a car making its way slowly towards the house, a black Nissan X-Trail with a 2019 number plate. It parks between the Bentley and the Aston Martin.
Now, as you say, the book is narrated by Chris Connell with Harley Vuhash and Chelsea Halfpenny. Were you responsible, other than Chris, responsible in any way for the casting of the narrators?
Yes. So I think that's one really, really exciting part about being an author and having an audiobook produced is that you always get sent some reels so you can have a listen. Because obviously, you know your characters better than anybody. So it was really good fun that the audio team kind of shortlisted, sent a few people over, and I had a listen. And I just thought that Harley and Chelsea just had the perfect tones for the two characters, because the two characters whose point of views we hear, so Harley is playing Paul and Chelsea is playing Cassie, of the siblings, they're the ones I think that we can most have compassion for. The siblings basically get more vile the older they get. But Paul and Cassie are the youngest. So, you know, by no means are they whiter than white. They're pretty questionable in terms of, especially Paul, in terms of his views, but he does have this side where he sort of checks himself. And so when I heard Harley's voice, I just thought, there's something in his voice, his tone, that just felt kind of like you could warm to the character. And I really needed that with Paul. And also, you know, to have somebody who is really experienced in doing audio work, who, because the character of Paul, actually, his point of view, as you go through the book, he becomes incredibly inebriated and you know, quite delirious from all the drugs he's taking. So to have somebody who was able to kind of bring that sense to life as well was really great. And Chelsea has done, she's done a couple of audio books. I think Chelsea's probably better known for her work in TV. She was a regular in Emmerdale and Casualty. And the book is based here in the Northeast, and she's got a really big Northeast profile as well. So, yeah, so it was great to be able to have that input. And it's a really exciting part of the author process, I think.
Was it quite an early decision that you knew you were going to have multiple narrators?
So the audio team, the editor, comes up with what you need. You basically, and this is another fun part of it, they send you a sort of audio questionnaire, so you can, as author, you can give your views in terms of, you know, what the characters are going to be like, what the accents are going to be like, anything unusual. So obviously unusual for this one is that, and my husband Chris Connell playing this part, was the descriptions, the kind of visual descriptions that are kind of scattered throughout the book that we are seeing through Iggy the Goat's camera. So it was kind of highlighting some of the kind of the quirks and the challenges that they might face when casting and planning it. And then they come back and say, right, so we will have an actor each for Cassie and Paul, and then one for, as we call it, goat cam. So yeah, they kind of come up with who's needed.
Now, you've given readings at festivals and at book talks. Have you never fancied narrating yourself?
Oh my God, absolutely not. No, I do really enjoy giving readings. Although I if I don't have my reading glasses with me, I really struggle these days. So I have had panicked moments when I've forgotten them and thought, oh my God, I can barely see these words on the page. So I always have to remember those. But I do really enjoy that. But I think that at an event, you know, the audience there are expecting to hear an author reading, whereas with an audiobook, I think they're expecting to hear professional actors bringing those characters to life. And I mean, seriously, as my husband, I cannot act. It's not something I can do. I have anxiety dreams about being on a stage and being unable to act, because I used to work in theatre years ago, but never, ever, ever on the stage. So, yeah, it's definitely not something I could do.
Now, one thing we'll miss if we download the book from the RNIB library is the cover. Can you give us a little description of the cover of the Party to End All Parties?
Absolutely. So it's got the kind of the classic thriller book vibe, which is the kind of the blues, the moody blues, and then the bright yellow writing. So it's got the Party to End All Parties. The text is kind of front and center. And then to the left, you've got this kind of outline of the back of, it's actually meant to be Cassie, the character. So you've got Cassie's sort of long sort of brown hair, and she's wearing a red, it's almost a bit Little Red Riding Hood, actually. And then across from that, you've got this beautifully lit up image of a stately home and a tree coming across from the right hand side. So, and then at the top, a little party never killed anyone ? So yeah, I'm really pleased with the cover.
Was the house actually based on a real place?
Yes, it was. So not the one on the cover, but I actually came up with the idea for the book after going to Seton Delaval Hall in the northeast, well, in Seton Delaval. So that's a National Trust property. And I went with my friend Cassie, hence me naming my protagonist Cassie. We were wandering around and we got to a part of the building, inside the building, where there were lots of images of the Delavals and the Delaval family, the Delaval siblings on the walls. And one of the volunteers spent a great deal of time with us telling us all these infamous stories about the Delavals. They were known to throw legendary three-day parties. They were known to play tricks on their guests. They were very flamboyant. They were a little bit reckless with money. And I just found it absolutely fascinating. And because I'd been such a fan of like Succession, I just thought, well, imagine if you set a thriller in a place like this with, you know, modern day, with siblings who were all kind of, they were all stuck together in this place. They were kind of tied to it. They were kind of reckless because they were so spoiled and rich and didn't really know anything beyond their estate in terms of, well, they certainly didn't have to fend for themselves. But if you throw in this kind of Succession style squabble between them for who's going to inherit the estate, I thought that would be quite good fun. So I've tried to, there are certain things in the book that are, you know, definitely inspired by Seton Delaval Hall. So the descriptions of the building, the descriptions of the fountain, the ice house, the cellar. So yeah, and I was able to chat to the estate manager as well to get a good understanding of, for example, where might you be able to hide a body in the grounds of an estate and things like that. So yeah, it's been great fun. And I even did a little bit of writing from the cafe there as well in the grounds of Seton Delaval Hall, which was just lovely. So yeah, it's very much inspired by the estate. It's kind of inspired by the fact that the Delavals were so kind of infamous and legendary and flamboyant, but my characters are all absolutely their own. So I am certainly not saying that the Delavals were vile narcissists, because my characters I've obviously come up with completely independently of that. But it was just the idea that the Delavals were a bit reckless and threw these legendary parties that inspired the novel.
That's not suspicious at all, just saying to the estate manager, where can I hide a body here?
Oh, so there is actually, oh, I don't know, it's a little bit of a spoiler, but I'll say it anyway, because I was asking about whether you could, you know, get into the wall cavities or anything like that, because I was really keen on that. But there is actually a hidden, well, it was hidden. They discovered kind of recently, like a trapdoor and a kind of a basement that they didn't know existed when they changed the flooring. That is actually on display now. The public can see it. So yeah, that was quite good fun learning about that and being shown it when the manager was giving me a tour.
Now, one person who's named on the cover with a wee quote is Lisa Timoney, who was on a couple of weeks ago, actually. Now, she uses different names for different genres, and I believe this is only your second thriller book, but you also write as Lucy Nicol. Why did you change to Lucy Roth for this genre?
So it was just to, so Avon, the publisher, do this when you write in different genres. I have written one thriller under Lucy Nicol, but that was my own self-published one, Girls to the Front. What I love about what Avon do with, you know, if you write in a different genre and they help you come up with a name, and the name is always a little bit of a play on the genre you're writing in. So I just think it's great fun. So Lucy Roth is obviously, you know, if you think of the word Roth as in W-R-A-T-H, and it was coming from when the first novel that I wrote for them, When Sally Killed Harry, was a very much rage-filled feminist revenge thriller. So the name just kind of really worked. And I know with Lisa Timoney, when she's written for Avon and she's written in the kind of the genre that explores, you know, book clubs and book communities, and the name that she uses for that is Kate's Story. And I just think it's so much fun how you do that for different genres. So yeah, I was really happy to go with that.
And we'll have more from Lucy after we take a visit to the RNIB Talking Books Library.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books Library. So here are two new gems.
Metallica, Enter Night, the biography by Mick Wall was given to us by Orion.
The first time James Hetfield met Lars Ulrich, he had him pegged. Rich kid, he said to himself. You know the type, got everything, an only child who didn't know the meaning of the word no. And so he was. Born into a house as big as a castle in the elegant town of Hellerup, the most fashionable part of the municipality of Gentofte in eastern Denmark, Lars Ulrich arrived on Boxing Day 1963. A late Christmas present for a childless couple in their mid-30s, old in those days for having babies. Lars was regarded as special from the day he was born. It was a view he would quickly grow to share. His father, Torben, was a tennis-playing veteran of over 100 Davis Cup matches, during which time he led the team to several finals, and a fully paid-up member of the emerging post-war jet set. His mother, Lone, a Bohemian den mother, who would spend her days keeping her perpetually moving husband's feet on the ground, or trying to. A star of the amateur tennis era who was already 40 yet still winning Grand Slam matches when he belatedly turned professional in the late 1960s, Torben's interests were not confined, however, merely to sport.
Alongside contemporaries Slayer, Megadeth and Anthrax, Metallica came to prominence in the 80s as one of the big four of thrash metal. Metallica were to thrash, though, what the Sex Pistols were to punk. Nearly 30 years on, their tale is one of alcohol, rule-breaking and tragically early death. But allied to that are colossal sales figures for their records and members with backgrounds that touch on jazz and classical music.
With the umbrella Danish sports authority in that amateur era limiting participation in tournaments abroad to just 56 days per year, he had time just to also become a skilled writer for Denmark's Politiken newspaper, a regular horn player in various jazz ensembles, and later artist, filmmaker, and practicing Buddhist. A long-haired, splendidly whiskered Gandalf-like figure whose obsession with physical and mental fitness continued long after his professional sports career ended, as he recalled in a 2005 interview. "Maybe I played tennis in the afternoons, and then I would go play music at night. And then after that, I had to go up to the newspaper and write reviews. And after that, maybe I would go meet some of my friends in the morning and have breakfast. And then I had to go to band practice at noon and play tennis at 3. All of a sudden, I hadn't slept for 3 or 4 days."
Enter Night, a biography of Metallica by Mick Wall, is read by Alistair Austin and runs for 17 hours and 37 minutes.
Secrets of the Starlit Sea by Santa Montefiore was donated by Orion.
It was midnight when the four ladies made their way purposefully through the Aldershof Hotel's lobby towards the Walter Wyatt drawing room, which lay on the other side of an imposing pair of white double doors. Light bounced off the marble floor and threw into relief the original French-inspired mouldings that adorned the ceilings and walls and the grand, sweeping staircase, once one of the finest in New York, that dominated the hall. If one was unaware of the time, it could easily have been the middle of the day, owing to the brightness of the electric lights and the various guests who sat in the comfy velvet chairs dotted about the lobby, staring into their smartphones. The slick young man at reception did not detain the women, for Mr. Sterling, the owner, had made it clear that they had important business to attend to and were not to be disturbed. The drawing room, therefore, had been reserved exclusively for their use, even though it was unlikely to be in high demand at this time of night.
The moment psychic detective Pixie Tate steps inside the opulent Aldershoff Hotel in Manhattan, one of the last relics of New York's Gilded Age, she senses instantly that a dark spirit is wreaking havoc within its elegant walls. Pixie knows that she must use her unique gift to travel back in time in order to discover the secrets of the past. And as she slips back over 100 years, she's shocked to find herself in the midst of one of the most famous events in history. As the stars twinkle overhead, Pixie realizes that time is running out. But when she comes face to face with a man she thought she'd lost forever, will she keep her promise to save only the souls she should? Or is it too late? And has she already changed the future?
Alma Aldershoff Blanchett Carrington, granddaughter of the great William Aldershoff, who had built this faux 17th century French chateau in 1872, moved surprisingly fast for a woman in her late 90s. She supported herself with a silver-handled walking stick, personally designed for her grandfather by Thomas Brigg and Sons of London back in the 1890s. Petite in both stature and bone, her demeanour, however, was far from frail. Dressed in a perfectly tailored black trouser suit, heavy gold chains at her throat and wrists, Alma had the air of a recalcitrant queen, shoulders back and chin held high, for as a child, she had raced over this very floor and scampered up that very staircase, and she still felt a deep sense of ownership. Although her mother had sold the grand house after her father's death in 1931, the 15-year-old Alma had never really got over its loss, or how the developers had, in her view, ripped out the very heart of her family home. Renovated, renewed, and remodeled over the subsequent 8 decades, it had morphed into a private members' club, a museum, and finally, this hotel, the Aldershoff. If the great William Aldershoff had been alive to witness such an affront to his masterwork, Alma was sure it would have done him in. Alma was still striking. Her hair, once a luscious brown, was now completely white and fastened into a loose updo held by a diamond comb, once belonging to her grandmother, the famous doyenne of Gilded Age society, Mrs. William Aldershoff, known to her friends as Dee Dee. Besides jewellery, with which Alma adorned her person in a feverish desire to connect herself to the past, and the heirlooms that she crammed into her small Brooklyn apartment, Alma had inherited the formidable Aldershoff chin and piercing blue eyes, and the strong, uncompromising will to go with them. She was accompanied by her daughter, Leona Croft, a fey and mousy woman of 64, who had inherited few of the Aldershoff genes and was meek and compliant with an over-anxious desire to please, and her 2 dear friends, Phyllis DeVere and Bonnie McAllister, who trailed behind her like a pair of aged bridesmaids.
Secrets of the Starlit Sea by Santa Montefiore is read by Genevieve Gaunt and runs for 12 hours and 6 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
If you have a question about sight loss, no matter how big or small, the RNIB helpline is there for you. From using your mobile to being more mobile, from making celebrations accessible for all the family to simply making a cake, we're here to help. Call us on 0303 123 9999 or ask your Amazon smart speaker to call the RNIB helpline.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
Let's return to Lucy Roth. And this time we start by chatting about her thriller novel, When Sally Killed Harry, which is read by Grace Blythe.
Dating used to be fun. Or at least, I thought it was. Maybe I'm simply feeling nostalgic and it's always been like this. It's boring. A slog. I've travelled all the way from London to New York. I've tried blind dates, been set up, used all the apps. And nothing's really changed. Men are still so predictable. They still want to explain to you why your opinions and tastes are incorrect. Sorry, let me back up a moment. You're probably wondering how I ended up killing Harry. Because I did kill Harry. Sweet, dangerous Harry. Not that it's a major spoiler or anything. I mean, it kind of says it on the tin. But I guess the answer to how it all went so very wrong begins with my disastrous dating career.
That's Grace Blythe reading From When Sally Killed Harry. Now, can you tell us a little bit about that book, your first thriller under the name Lucy Roth?
So When Sally Killed Harry is obviously a play on When Harry Met Sally, but turning it around for the sort of the feminist revenge thriller market. There's been loads of really good feminist revenge thrillers that are out there. And it's a kind of a fun one. I mean, it's quite dark. You know, I'd certainly had content warnings for people reading it because there are, you know, it's basically about women getting their own back when they have experienced abuse and violence at the hands of men. But the main story that runs throughout it is Sally. She is from the UK. She moves to New York and she is on the dating scene and she is so like fed up with all these terrible dates she has until she meets Harry. And she immediately, in spite of herself, because she's, you know, she's so cynical, but she immediately kind of starts to fall for him. And he turns out to be a con man. So the story is about her getting her revenge on Harry. And along the way, she brings together a group of other wronged women who all come together. They're kind of like a peer support group and they all sort of support each other in helping each other get their revenge on the various men that have wronged them. So it's kind of a lot of fun, but also very, very dark as well.
And when you heard Grace Blythe, did she just become Sally for you?
Oh my God, the moment I heard her, I mean, the fact that she is, I think she's like American English, so she can do both accents brilliantly. But I don't even think I listened to anyone else. The minute I heard her voice, I was just like, yes, 100%. She could just bring Sally to life. It was brilliant.
So here we are, a few months earlier, in a restaurant called Cheruti's, sitting across from the most boring man in Manhattan. I can't believe you've never been to Osaka. My date, this one's called Dan, is smirking at me. It's literally the only place worth going if you're going to try it. I groan inwardly, but my face seems to be set in a mask of polite interest. I am well versed in masking. I go every time I visit Japan. He holds a glass of red in his hand, swilling it theatrically in circles as he eyeballs it. The eddying red liquid seems to taunt me. And he seems completely oblivious to how close to the edge I am. Boredom and simmering rage are strange bedfellows. No matter how many times I am subjected to this torture, it never gets any easier.
Now, you've written in the past non-fiction articles about mental health, and reading some of them, there's a bit of a crossover because RNIB recently had a campaign called See the Person, Not the Sight Loss. Do you think someone with a condition, be it a mental health problem, a disability, sight loss, do you think in writing there's a danger that that's all they become. They become the blind guy, or they become the guy in the wheelchair.
Oh, yeah, I think 100%. And I've spent a lot of time as well working with TV soaps and dramas, like working with their script teams on behalf of charities such as Mind and Action on Postpartum Psychosis and Recovery Connections. And I think, like, this is why I think that the soaps are actually really good at getting these stories right, because when you've got such a long running series and the characters have been in there for a long time, you get to know the character and then you see what they're experiencing. I have seen some quite bad examples when, you know, somebody has been introduced as a guest character to a storyline within a soap, but they're just kind of in it for that specific storyline, and they're introduced with a mental health problem and you don't get to know who they are. You just see the mental health problem. It doesn't happen as often anymore because so many now consult with charities and experts, etc. But I have seen that happen, and I think that is a danger. It's that thing where, you know, we always say when I've worked with mental health charities and working in mental health comms, that you never describe a person as, you know, a depressive. They are a person who experiences depression. That's a part of who they are. You know, somebody is not a schizophrenic. They might be a talented writer, mother, sister who also lives with schizophrenia. So I do think it's a really, really important thing to, like you say, see the person, not the sight loss or not the diagnosis, definitely.
And to turn that on its head a wee bit, is humour quite important within that writing?
So I've used humour. I do use humour, and I've written novels like The 27 Club and Park Life were both focused on mental health and addiction problems. I think the way I try to do it is that I think humour is a great way to kind of engage people. I think it's always really good to have that bit of light when you're exploring issues that can be quite difficult. But for example, in The 27 Club, which is in itself about kind of exposing the media sensationalism behind coining of the 27 Club about rock stars dying aged 27 and kind of saying, actually, there is so much more to these talented people than a number. So that book that I wrote was exploring a character with quite extreme health anxiety and panic attacks. So I did, to make her relatable, I got her in all sorts of like really funny situations, you know, a bit farcical at times, like, you know, the way she meets her new love interest, for example, was quite farcical and cringy. But what I never, ever did was make light of the anxiety that she experienced, the panic attack. So if I wrote a panic attack, I didn't inject humor into that, but I did inject humor into the character's broader life experience, if that makes sense. Because I just think you shouldn't belittle. However, one thing I do think is okay is for the character or yourself, because I know, you know, I've lived with an anxiety disorder for years. I've been on antidepressants for 10 years. I do sometimes enjoy kind of adding a bit of light when I reflect on my own experiences, you know, so it is helpful for me to be able to have a little giggle at some of the things that I've thought or said or done when I've, you know, been mid panic attack, for example. But I think it's really important that that is a personal choice, and we should never project that onto somebody else, if that makes sense, like to identify areas that we can make light of ourselves is fine. But I don't think we should ever point at somebody else's experience and do that. So I think with humour, there's a lot of nuance to be considered.
The last book of Lucy's that we'll feature on today's show is No Worries If Not. It's available in the RNIB library and is under the name Lucy Nicol, and it's narrated by Anna Gilthorpe.
I'm not a psychopath or anything. I mean, if I'm watching a thriller or something, and there's a scene early on where one of the good characters fills up a cat food bowl and calls for Mr. Whiskers or whoever, then I turn it off straight away because, come on, We all know how that's going to end. Ditto a dog food bowl or a rabbit hutch. I know I won't be able to cope with what's coming because deep down, I'm a softie. And I can live with that. But this, I didn't feel sad about this. I felt angry. I mean, how could I be sad about someone who turned out not to be the person I thought they were? No, I was fuming. Although, if I'm being honest, I was also really embarrassed by all the rumours at school. All I wanted to do was hide away in my room. But of course, Mam took that to mean I was missing him, which couldn't be further from the truth.
That was Anna Gilthorpe reading from No Worries If Not.
So No Worries If Not, it comes from the fact that, I mean, and I've been so guilty of this, when we add No Worries If Not to the end of an email or the end of a text, it's kind of, it's just very apologetic in nature. It's like, you want to ask a friend to go out for dinner one night and you go, oh, do you fancy coming out with me one night? I thought we could do this, or go see this show. No worries if not. As if you were kind of saying, actually, you probably don't want to hang out with me. So here's your get out clause. So it's kind of like it's become a thing in society that a lot of us sign off with. But it is linked to being kind of very apologetic and feeling like a bit of an imposter, I suppose. And so, yeah, No Worries If Not, the novel, it's a bit of a feminist comedy where Charlotte realizes that she apologizes for literally everything. And she makes a pact with herself to give up saying sorry, basically, and not just, you know, the S word, but all of the different ways in which she is kind of behaving apologetically rather than assertively and confidently. But yeah, she realizes that this pact to stop saying sorry for a year is actually a lot more difficult than she thought, and that there are actually some situations where saying sorry is appropriate. So yeah, so it's kind of, it's another kind of fun, farcical comedy, but with a kind of bit of feminism at its heart, because it is something that I think, well, you know, men of course do over apologize and sign off with no worries if not at times. I do think that an imposter syndrome is something that is bigger among women. So yeah, it's got a bit of feminism at heart as well.
Is music important to your writing?
Hugely important. So the first novel that I wrote, The 27 Club, which was the prequel to Park Life, I think it kind of came at a time where I just turned 40 and, you know, hitting that sort of midlife crisis sort of stage. And I started listening to all the old 90s music that I loved as a teenager and reminiscing and going to more gigs of, you know, the 90s bands that were still on the gig circuit. And it was just such a major time for me, I suppose, finding my tribe as a teenager and finding the music and the musicians that I loved and that I found really inspiring. And so I just wanted to set something around that. So to almost have music and fan communities and fandom and going to gigs as a bit of a backdrop. So that's where the 27 Club came from. Because I was already working in mental health, that kind of provided the driver for the protagonist. And then Park Life follows on from that. So I went from the 27 Club, which focused more on kind of grungy pop punky music, into Park Life, set in 1996. And obviously from the title, kind of focused a bit more around Britpop. And it even opens with the character making up. She's actually making a cake, a birthday cake for her partner, boyfriend John, and she's listening to Pulp, and she sings along to it, and she makes up her own words because she's singing to her dog, her whippet Trevor. So it even opens with a Britpop song in that respect. But yeah, music is it's really important to me in my life, so it has featured quite a bit in quite a few of my books, actually.
The Party to End All Parties by my guest Lucy Roth is available commercially in print, as an ebook, and in audio, and it's also on the way to the RNIB library. When Sally killed Harry, and No Worries If Not are available from RNIB now. But remember, No Worries is under the name Lucy Nicol. And Lucy will be back for Books of My Life in a moment.
This is an RNIB talking book.
Every weekday on RNIB Connect Radio, we bring you a classic RNIB talking book, serialised and played in full over time.
The Picture of Dorian Gray by Oscar Wilde.
The Old Curiosity Shop by Charles Dickens.
Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson.
You'll hear much-loved novels and timeless favourites brought to life by some truly brilliant narrators who know how to let a story breathe.
Hello, I'm Richard Burnett.
Hello, I'm John Cormack.
Hello, I'm Garrick Hagen.
Join us every weekday at 2 p.m. with a repeat at 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime.
I'm Michael Palin, and you're listening to Talking Books
only on RNIB Connect Radio.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
And finally, a return to Lucy Roth for the Books of Her Life. Is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading?
So this isn't a book as such. It was a series of audio books. So you had the magazine and you had the tape, and it was the Storyteller series. And there was one particular edition of that, which was the Christmas Storyteller, which had various short stories in. And I absolutely adored it. I can't even tell you why. I mean, I am crazy about Christmas, but there were stories in there like Bertie's Great Escapade and What Wanda Wanted. And yeah, it was just, I just adored that Storyteller series. There was regular stories in there about Gobelino the Witch's Cat as well, which I loved. So I think whilst it's not your traditional book, it was something that I absolutely adored as a child. And I rebought copies from eBay recently as well.
Bertie was a pig of action. Deeds, not grunts, was his motto. Retreating as far back as he could, he took a sharp run, gave a mighty jump, and cleared the railings round his sty. "The rabbits shall come too," he said. "Do them good." He went to the rabbit hutch and unfastened the door. "Peter! Benji!" he called. "Wake up!" "Whatever are you up to, Bertie?" said Peter sleepily. "Hurry up!" said Bertie. "We are going carol singing. Bring Benji too." Peter hopped out at once in great delight, but Benji grumbled and burrowed down in his straw, so they hauled him out by his ears. Cautiously they crept down the paddock, past the house and out at the front gate. Down the hill they went, took the turning by the pillar box, and arrived at the foot of Chalk Pit Hill. Then Benji came to a halt.
"Hang it all," he said. "I'm not going to slog all the way up that hill tonight for anyone."
"Then I'll bite you," said Bertie. "Choose which you please."
"It's all right, Bertie," said Peter. "We are none of us going to slog up that hill. I know a much easier way. You just follow me."
He led them into the chalk pit until they stood at the foot of a cliff. Peter pulled out a large lump of chalk and disclosed the entrance to a long, dark little tunnel. "Come on," he said, and dived in. And the others followed. They felt their way along the tunnel for a considerable time in darkness and silence, till at last they saw a glimmer of light. The tunnel ended suddenly in a neat little lift, lit up with electric light, with a seat running round three sides of it. A mole was standing by the door.
"Come along there, please, if you're going up," called the mole sharply.
They hurried in and sat down. "Just in time," said Peter.
"Any more for the lift?"
cried the mole, looking down the tunnel.
Then he stepped inside smartly, slammed the door, pulled the rope, and they shot upwards. "Well, I never," gasped Bertie.
That's Bernard Cribbins reading Bertie's Escapade from The Christmas Storyteller. There's no official digital release of the series, but they are all available on YouTube. And is there a book on a rainy day you could happily curl up with and reread?
Oh, so this has been a recent thing. So I had never read any Jilly Cooper books before. And then Disney had Rivals, and I watched that series, like, I think I've watched it 7 times over. And then I started listening to the audiobook for Rivals, and it's the newer edition narrated by Georgia Tennant. And she brings the characters to life in a very similar way to the actual cast of the Disney series. And I just adore it because I feel like I'm hanging out with my mates. Like, I don't have friends at all like the people in Rivals. But I think it's just one of those comfort reads where you've got to know the world and the characters so well that whenever I just feel like I need to turn off the chaos in my head, I just stick that audiobook back on. It's 20 hours long. It doesn't matter where it is. I know the story inside out, and it just feels so good to hang out with that cast of characters. So that's the one for me that I keep returning to.
Sitting in the Concorde departure lounge at Heathrow on a perfect blue June morning, Anthony, 2nd Baron Baddingham, Chairman and Managing Director of Corinium Television, should have been perfectly happy. He was blessed with great wealth, a title, a brilliant career, a beautiful flat in Kensington, houses in Gloucestershire and Tuscany, a loyal, much-admired wife, 3 charming children, and a somewhat demanding mistress, to whom he had just bidden a long farewell on the free telephone beside him. He was about to fly on his favourite aeroplane, Concorde, to his favourite city, New York, to indulge in his favourite pastime, selling Corinium's programmes to American television and raising American money to make more programmes. Tony Baddingham was a great believer in using other people's money, or OPM, as he called it. Then, if a project bombed, someone else picked up the bill. As a final bonus, neatly folded beside him were the morning papers, which he'd already read, in the Post House Hotel, and which all contained glowing reports of Corinium's past 6 months' results, announced yesterday. Just as he had been checking out of the Post House an hour earlier, however, Tony's perfect pleasure had been ruined by the sight of his near neighbour and long-term rival, Rupert Campbell Black, checking in. He was scribbling his signature with one hand and holding firmly onto a rather grubby but nonetheless ravishing girl with the other. The girl, who had chipped nail polish, wildly tangled blonde hair, mascara smudged under her eyes and a deep suntan, had obviously been pulled out of some other bed and was giggling hysterically. "Rupert," she wailed. "There simply isn't time. You'll miss the plane." "It'll wait," said Rupert, and gathered up his keys, started to drag her towards the lift. As the doors closed like curtains coming down on the first act of a play, Tony could see the two of them glued together in a passionate embrace. A deeply competitive man, Tony had felt dizzy with jealousy.
That's Georgia Tennant reading from Rivals by Jilly Cooper, which is available commercially. Rivals is available in the RNIB library, as read by Gwen Sherrill. And is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but something you've read recently, fresh in the mind, you'd like to recommend.
I always go back to the same one, but I'm going to go back to it again, which is The Lamb by Lucy Rose, which has been quite the bestseller. It's done amazingly well. And it's a folk horror set in the woods, and it explores relationships between female cannibals. So it's a really interesting world, and Lucy Rose, the author, has made it so vivid and so engrossing that you're reading it and feeling immensely uncomfortable what you're reading, but for some reason you're desperate to dive back into that world and immerse yourself in that world at every opportunity. So I would highly recommend The Lamb.
On my 4th birthday, I plucked 6 severed fingers from the shower drain. The tub yellowed near the plug hole, and there was a peachy hue up the curve of the bath. It was the same colour as my skin. Milky and a little buttery, like the outer edges of a bruise. Mildew and dried-up water peppered the glass screen. Black mould had crawled up the plaster in between the grout. The bathroom was small, and the dark corners harboured cobwebs, rings of damp and hairline cracks. I wanted to lick the black speckles of mould littered along the wall. I hoped it would taste as it smelt, like musty brambles or rain splashing in a muddy puddle. The first finger I picked up had purple polish flaking away from its nail. The second was clean of cosmetics, but it was short, bitternut and uneven along its ridge. My fingertip followed the edge of the nail. When I looked down at the plug hole, I realised the rest of the fingers were too far gone to tell anything about who they'd once been attached to. All I knew is that, at some point along the way, strangers had come to our homestead and Mama had gladly taken them in. There had been at least one girl wearing purple nail polish and a clean-cut boy who nibbled at his fingernails when he was nervous. The boy was especially nervous around Mama, wide-eyed and alert. They had strayed too far from the main road and ended up here, tangled up among the knotted hair gathered in our shower drain. The girl liked Mama very much, before she was reduced to just a couple of fingers at my feet. Mama plied her with wine and they danced to old cassettes in the living room until it was dark. We mixed the wine with mashed-up hemlock, just enough to make a stray woozy, but not enough to harm us when we later consumed them. Mama told me it was a hex, one that took them to slumber, calm and quiet. It made their lungs slow to a pulse.
The Lamb Lucy Rose is available commercially as narrators by Emma Rydal. That's all we've got time for on today's edition of Read On. We'll be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, every episode is available as a podcast. Just search for RNIB Read On. And remember to tune in every weekday at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. for our sister show, Talking Books, where we showcase the best that RNIB Library has to offer that we're allowed to play on air. Listen live or catch up online at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.